Hi, you are listening to a free Majority Report. If you would like to become a member, please go to majority.fm.
Yeah, say your name.
Oh, my name's Janine Garofalo. How are you?
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 11th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday, folks. But perhaps too casual. Cliff Schechter's on vacation. Lost somewhere in the Magic Kingdom. Or Epcot. Somewhere in the Disney World, ladies and gentlemen. So joining us today will be Guy Lawson, author of Octopus, and the forthcoming book of which name I don't know, about those stoner arms dealers that he has written about in the past. He's also a writer for Rolling Stone magazine. And later in the program, to provide movie reviews for us this week, or a movie recommendation, will be Matthew Film Guy, live in studio. Also on the program today, the Republicans come out with a new hostage demand. This is like number 47, I think. They've actually come out, I think, with more now things that they're requiring to allow the debt ceiling to be raised and the government to open. More different things than the number of times they actually voted to defund Obamacare.
Did you see what Obama was reported to have said in a meeting with congressional Democrats?
You got to be effing kidding me?
He said, the only thing that's missing from their demand list is my resignation.
Yes, I'm sure they'll get to it. I'm sure they'll get to it.
Well, the president hasn't offered to resign yet.
This is literally breaking news that they have come out with a request for spending cuts. the Republicans have. But nobody knows what those requests are. And it's and nobody's really taking it seriously because this party is a complete joke. We'll talk to Guy about that. Get his unique perspective on it. Also, extreme poverty hits a new high in this country. And we will dig into the real reasons why Disney has increased the number of its theme park workers in their hours, made them full-time. Does it have anything to do with Obamacare? Did, whatever it was, Shark World down there, when they cut theirs, did it have anything to do with Obamacare? And the poll that has come out today that really has... I don't think I've ever seen a poll have this type of impact amongst the political reporting class, which shows the Republicans just in a free fall and are doing so poorly that actually the numbers for the Affordable Care Act have gone up. We will discuss that as well. We will get to that story about the mineral rights. And for those of you who, I think we've covered this story mostly in the better half of the program, but that chief of police, Kessler, from a small town in Pennsylvania, the one whose videos we have critiqued, featured, wherein he refers to people as libtards, and that's the only thing that I can say of his favorite bon mots on his video before he starts shooting semi-automatic and automatic weapons into the side of a hill. Funny story about his disciplinary hearing. Apparently, they had to stop it in the middle because one of his supporters dropped a loaded gun on the floor. I know. Also, an incredibly poignant report on press freedoms has come out by the Center for Journalistic Freedom. Usually, you see reports like this by this outfit about places like Russia and Syria or Korea. And it is an incredibly damaging report. And a lot of U.S. Reporters are on record. And, of course, we will get to the story of the rabbis in New York City who who are apparently kidnapping men who will not provide the required sign-off to get divorced if you're an Orthodox Jew. And they're apparently tasing them in vans. All that and more on today's program. Yeah, it's Casual Friday, folks. I don't know what to tell you.
Is that one because of Obamacare?
That, of course, is a function of Obamacare.
As a result of Obamacare, we will cattle prod to husbands for you for a divorce.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Guy Lawson. It's Casual Friday, folks. Really casual. Hey, Majority Report listeners, you know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to getting sponsors for the show. And I can't say enough about Credo Mobile. They're our newest sponsor. They're the only progressive cell phone company in the country. This is really the best of both worlds for me. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, holds Democrats accountable, funds the progressive movement, fights climate change, and helps keep this show on the air. It's really easy to sign up right now. Go to credomobile.com/Sam to get 25% off your data for the first 2 years. You get true unlimited data, and they'll even give you a buyout credit of $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers. Look, they're supporting the show, they're a great product, and they do great political work. It's a win-win-win. Go to credomobile.com/Sam to get that deal right now. And we talk about that, like myself. Like myself. Like myself. Nicotine really goes to my head. Feeling all in. Take some aspirin. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen, filling in for Cliff Schechter, who is on vacation in Disney World with his family, is my good friend Guy Lawson, writer for the Rolling Stone magazine, author of, well, his latest was The Octopus, Wonderful story on a hedge fund fraudster. Do I have that right, Guy?
That's right. He's Sam Israel's his name.
Okay. And we, of course, spoke to you about it. People should go back and listen to the interview about Sam Israel. You'll enjoy it. Guy, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to fill in.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't want you to think of yourself as a fill-in in this way. But people, we usually are playing the Cliff Schechter theme song on Fridays. And so I don't want people to have a heart attack about this. Now,
well, I could have a theme song. It could be O Canada.
Well, that's all right. Okay. This is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. and we should say, and I want to talk to you about the book that you've been writing on, one of my favorite stories ever, about the two, well, I guess they were late teens, early 20s, basically potheads who ended up doing one of the largest arms deals in the history of the United States during the Bush administration.
I just yesterday finished the book.
What's it going to be called?
It's called Arms and the Dudes, and it will come out, I'm not sure, but probably in summer or fall of next year. I've never had the chance to really sort of prepare a book for publication, so it'll be interesting to see if we really can get some good marketing and promotion behind it. But it's exciting to finish a book. It's sort of a strange feeling. It's like, sort of having a long relationship come to an end. It's, you're happy about it at the same time as you're kind of a little confused about what's next. But, it was a really fun and interesting thing. And so people who recall that story, it's basically a couple of kids from Miami Beach who got extremely good at bidding online for federal contracts. And they won a $300 million deal to supply all the ammunition to the Afghan National Army. And it's an incredible, dopey adventure into, how America's waged war in the last decade. But the reason I wrote a book is that I knew that there's a lot more to the story than I was able to write about in Rolling Stone, and indeed that turned out to be the case. There's some sort of large frame things that I've discovered. I think the biggest of which is, and I didn't really understand this when I wrote about it for Rolling Stone, is that these kids were really basically beards or front people for the Pentagon. The Pentagon couldn't go and buy all this surplus ammo from these dirty gun runners in the Balkans. They needed someone to go do that work for them. And that's the large frame for this thing is sort of like, if you think of Lindy English, the guard who was at Abu Ghraib and her colleague, how they were supposed to be like the aberration, the torturers, when really there was a larger policy at work. It's similar to that. The Pentagon was basically exempted itself from international and domestic law related to dealing with illegal gun runners, and these kids therefore went out and did all this, slimy, sleazy stuff. And then when the lights got flicked on, the Pentagon pretended that they were shocked that there was gambling going on in that casino.
I think this dynamic, and it's interesting because that element of the story was something. Obviously, you and I have talked about this over the years. But that was that element of the story was not present in that early reporting, and in some ways I think that dynamic of an entity, and I'm thinking in the context of, because I'm so debt ceiling centric right now and government shutdown centric right now, but as we watch the machinations here, the entity in question, and I'm trying to draw a parallel here between, say, the Obama administration and the Pentagon. They have an agenda. They are not sure. They set up a context in which they're hoping there will be an agent to carry that agenda forward, and they're not sure what it's going to be when they set up that context. It at one point within that sort of miasma of that context reveals itself, and they just go full hog on that context. I mean, in some ways, is that what happened there? Is that the Pentagon? Go ahead.
The thing I think about it is that private contractors, the rhetoric around use of private contractors or the free market to do government work, and this relates maybe to to the medical reforms, is that they're more efficient, is that they can, that they're responsive. But, what really is going on, I think, is that no one becomes responsible. You know, what happens is that, you know, you can get Blackwater out there to shoot a bunch of people in the, on the streets of Baghdad, and no one will pay a price for it. So, you know, the way I kind of see it is that, like, there's this the baby boom, this generation, you know, and I guess I'd have to include myself, and it's just like this rampaging lack of responsibility that's taking over society. And the debt ceiling feels like that, too. Like, you know, we're going to shut down government. We're going to not pay our bills. For why again? You know, just it's like power, it's become such a one-way relationship between power and the powerless. So in this, in the case of the arms dealers, you know, who are the people that took the fall for this? The two kids in Miami Beach, right? The two people who weren't had no power base, but they were State Department officials, Justice Department officials, Pentagon officials who were doing really sleazy things, super sleazy things. And the documents were all sort of buried under, you know, a seal by a federal judge. The result, the upshot, and this is an amazing thing that I really am reporting now, just been reporting the last few days, is that when they canceled the contract to stop these kids because they were such deviant fraudsters, the result of it was is that the Afghan army and police were without ammunition. So, you know, like, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to totalize it, but and so on some level, this debt ceiling, the whole way that things are discussed, it never really seems to get to the core of, like, who's responsible for this and what is actually happening. You know, it gets caught up in this rhetoric and this nonsense, and legalistic or media-like nonsense. Anyway, that's I don't want
to... No, well, I mean, I think actually, I mean, that's fascinating to me because, I mean, I think that is, on some level... The you know, Chris Hayes wrote that book about the failure of the elites and this being the,
yeah,
sort of the fail decade. And the thing that really does mark it is the complete lack of accountability. And
Dick Cheney, man, like it's just astonishing. And Obama is totally enabling that.
I mean, I think it's not just even enabling. I mean, we see this in the context of the national security state. I mean, there are sort of certain dynamics that stick out for me, like, you know, the NSA basically saying, giving the Israelis all the raw data, but got to make a promise that you won't break our constitutional protections of domestic individuals. Of course, on the other hand, they're not domestic if you're in Israel, because they live in America. I mean, there is a fundamental lack of accountability that's taking place amongst our elites. And beyond that, there seems to be an aggressive agenda to farm out accountability in as many ways as possible.
Yeah, you know, Edward Snowden, the thing about Edward Snowden that's most appalling to the elites is that he called them to account. You know, and conversely, they obviously my arms dealing guys did not, you know, weren't leaking stuff. But what they did was they provided a prism through which to see the elite that was deeply unflattering. It showed them to be incompetent, venal, and at the end of the day, stupid. You know,
right.
It's so, you know, I don't know, you know, this is the sort of, my hope is that the next generation, younger people, are going to be, you know, when they brush up against this sensibility, are going to be, you know, more and more inclined to rebel against it.
What do you think it is that has, I mean, you say that it's our generation. I mean, you are significantly older than me.
You know, it's don't you feel like that this sort of the elites of this era now are just like singularly irresponsible?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they are completely irresponsible, and I think that it's beyond sort of the happenstance of a random incompetent. It seems to be the idea of lack of accountability seems to be a value now. I mean,
yeah,
it is no
yeah.
longer like a bug. It seems to be a feature of success, of empowerment in this country. I mean, you know, I
witnessed it. I remember I did a profile of Tom DeLay about 10 years ago for GQ magazine. And that was the most astonishing thing about that guy, just the complete and total heedlessness of it all, you know? You know, he you know, all these people who were impeaching Bill Clinton, this is not Tom DeLay, but to so to speak, impeaching Bill Clinton who were having, Newt Gingrich, you know, having sexual affairs themselves. It's just nutty.
Well, you know, some people describe that we live in sort of a post-truth political era, but I think that's, I mean, I think it's even beyond...
politics. You don't think it's Jacques Derrida here?
I think we're getting very close. But I think it goes beyond politics. I mean, I think, you know, we see it in the context of you know, where, like, board of directors and CEOs, their agenda is so, it seems to me, their incentive structure is so divorced from, so misaligned with the entities that, in the corporations, in this case, that they oversee in terms of their long-term health, that there is a, there's just the incentive structures in our society is just so messed up that it is a value if you can, in some way, avoid accountability and sort of everything is a side bet in some ways.
Yeah, yeah, if you're getting over. Yeah, you know, and so, you know, here we are doing our little bit to talk about that, but at the end of the day, it's like, you know, there's just these great grinding wheels moving forward. And, you know, to me, we need 100,000 Edward Snowdens and, you know, and lots of stories about kids coming up against the government and reflecting back like the emperor's wearing no clothing.
I don't know if you've had a chance, you know, because obviously you've been finishing your book. But yeah. The Committee to Protect Journalists came out with a report yesterday.
Oh, this has been grinding my grits like crazy. I think this is like literally the single most dangerous thing about Obama's two terms. This is it. Because if journalism doesn't get protected by a president like Obama, then when is it? You know, all these they're surveilling journalists, the Committee to Protect Journalists. I read that report very carefully. Yeah, you know, I deal with stories that often involve wrongdoing in government and or in powerful corridors. And, you know, the idea that I you know, that they can subpoena secretly, you know, monitor my phone calls, my emails, that they can, you know, do these digital searches on everything that I've looked at online, it's literally insane. And it's a perfect example of this one-way accountability. You know, Eric Holder has prosecuted more journalists and done more to harm freedom of press than the 10 attorney generals before him. And how does that not get discussed? You know, I tried.
Well, let me ask you, let me just want to set this up because I mentioned it briefly in the opening of the show, but it's the Committee to Protect Journalists. The report was written by Leonard Downey, who was a former executive.
Hardly a rebel, right? He's like the Mr. Establishment.
Indeed. And the former executive editor of The Washington Post, I mentioned early on that usually you see these reports about, you know, Russia or North Korea. And Downey said the administration's war on leaks and other efforts to control information are the most aggressive I've seen since the Nixon administration. He was one of the editors involved in the Washington Post investigation of Watergate. But, you know, others go on to say that it's not, I mean, it's not just about, and obviously you were doing reporting in the context of this book on, you know, what could be considered at least vaguely national security issues. But the
no, reports... No, you know what, Sam? I can interrupt it. It involves things that are... That there's jeopardies attached to the publication of this book that are significant for me. And information that is confidential. And so, you know, this has a direct relationship to my life, which is... You know, which is to mean to say that I'm actually going about the business of reporting. So, you know, when the Edward Snowden comes out and basically Glenn Greenwald, you know, commits like maybe the best piece of journalism in years, you know, people like even lefty sort of people like Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo, like think that it's terrible that this stuff is being exposed. All these mainstream journalists, oh, my goodness, how could you expose these things? Everyone's going to be in danger now, as if truth, you know, is somehow inherently dangerous, as if exposing the abuses of power of these secret shady forces is somehow, you know, anti-democratic or, you know, inherently bad. And it's, you know, it's the opposite. That's what journalists should be doing, but it's been so sort of lost and sold out. Journalism is so sold out now that in the mainstream media, for sure, and I think even in alternative media, a lot of cases, that it's the basic function of the press has been lost, you know? So here, give you a good example. The arms dealing story. Okay, so I wrote a story for Rolling Stone about it. The story of Rolling Stone was focused really primarily on the unbelievable craziness of this story and the personalities of the kids and and just like, you know, the happenstance of it. Are you there, Sam?
Yep. Go ahead.
And you know, that, and now I've written a book, and the book is, you know, really concerned with, you know, hopefully it's going to be even more fun than the article and lots of dope smoking and bongs and stuff like that. But it's also got this other kind of policy aspect to it, or more serious investigation of government conduct. But the first time that story ran was in the New York Times on the front page. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
So it ran, and the New York Times, one of their leading journalists, wrote a story about it. And the take of this leading journalist in the New York Times was essentially that these kids had defrauded the government, and that the Pentagon was somehow simultaneously idiotic and a victim of this, these devious
19-year-olds,
sleazy kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
It never has occurred to, and this is something that's going to be another controversy about the book, at least in my little life, is, didn't occur to the New York Times to ask questions about, was the Pentagon really fooled? Did they know what was going on? What were the Pentagon policies related to procurement from sleazy arms dealers in the Balkans? Were they really naive, or was there something more cynical happening? And so, you know, that's an example where the journalist, it's, you know, the journalism is so like in the pocket of the establishment, the fundamental questions don't get asked. You know, like simple things like, really? Two kids just pulled that off, like, you know, and victimized the poor Pentagon? Really? You know, so, you know, you put that on top of this surveillance culture, and journalism just seems like under siege in this country right now to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating point, because that was the reaction that everybody had, like, this is quite a caper. These guys, how did they, you know, and the Pentagon is just so restricted by all of these sort of specific rules and regulations that they just had to set up this website and just go with the flow. And it really is sort of amazing that it never occurred to anybody like, hey, wait a second, maybe there's some other dynamic at play here. I mean, that definitely seems to sort of characterize our journalism in some fashion, is sort of just a completely flat and two-dimensional.
Exactly, Sam. My mentor, and if, you know, if your listeners really want to have spend an enjoyable couple of hours or an hour or whatever looking at the work of one of the greatest journalists of the 20th century, his name is Murray Sale, S-A-Y-L-E. And he's an Aussie guy. He was a really incredibly intrepid guy, you know, like climbed Everest, sailed the Atlantic, covered Vietnam, frontline journalist, you know, found Che Guevara where Che Guevara disappeared, you know, broke the, you know, the Cambridge spy ring. I mean, he's just an amazing, amazing guy. And he had a basic theory about journalism. So Murray was the lead reporter for the London Times in the 1960s and 70s for the magazine, which was at the time the leading forum in the world for investigative journalism. So he was really a legend, this guy. And he was assigned by Harry Evans, who's married to Tina Brown, who's like this, you know, people probably know who Harry Evans is, who was then the editor of the magazine, to investigate Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland. And Murray went over to Belfast, and he'd just been in Vietnam, and he basically reported the story as a combat journalist would. You know, he looked at where the guns were, where the shots came from, where the civilians were, you know, how it played out. And he wrote a story which basically said that the British military had attacked unarmed civilians and murdered them. Harry Evans, he submitted the story to Harry Evans. Harry Evans submitted it to the Prime Minister, and they killed the story, reassigned Murray to Cairo, and he resigned, and the story didn't run until 25 years later, after Murray had passed away, when it was proven by royal commissions that Murray's report had been to the letter right. I'll tell you all that long story to say this. Murray's basic premise for journalism is that stories get framed in the first minute or two or half an hour or day, and then people never question the premise. And so his gift to me was always question the premise. You know, that's what I did with Arms and the Dudes. It's like that's what journalism should be doing all the time.
I mean, how sort of, you know, because it seems to me that sort of, you know, journalists function so much in their own sort of silos and universe. But I mean, how much of a sense do you get? And I know a lot of your friends, obviously, are journalists. I mean, how much of a sense do you get of like where people are? I mean, one of the things that really struck me about this CJR report is how many journalists were willing to go on the record and talk about this. I mean, a CPJ report. I mean, what level of consciousness is there out there about this?
You know, I'm a bit of a lone wolf. I'm not really like, I'm not down at the sort of, the watering hole with the guys on Friday afternoon. My sense of it is that there's a lot of complacency at the institutional level. That's to say, if you're the New York Times guy or the Washington Post guy, I think that there's more upset a little bit on the margins, like at McClatchy and places where they're doing Bloomberg, say, where they're doing more, sort of entrepreneurial kind of reporting, where it's less institutional. But, my sense of it is that the people who are sort of succeeding in the journalism game are upset by this, but they're not like alarmed the way I think they should be.
And what's it going to take? I mean, do you think that again, I think it's a sort of like another example of sort of the, you are responsible for less accountability if you hold others less accountable, it seems to me. I mean, that was the one thing I felt like, back in the in the days when I was sort of doing the sitcom work. I just sort of felt like there was just sort of this, wink, like, hey, we're all sitting in a room. I'm the writer. You're the executive. There's a bunch of us around here. Let's just all agree that this is going to be good. All right. I mean, it's a piece of garbage, but everybody, we're all on the same page here. And then nobody gets held to account. And this sort of just keeps rolling along until it, implodes or fades away. And then you just go on to the next thing and everybody gets paid.
I thought that the most revealing remark in this whole sort of the way this journalism surveillance story has played, one of the key moments was when they were secretly surveilling without any legal sanction the reporting of a couple of guys that were looking into, and I can't remember exactly what the matter was, but a national security issue. And so there was no like FISA court, no judicial imprint on this. They just basically pulled up these guys' phone calls. I think they were Associated Press guys, actually. And Eric Holder said, I went home on the weekend and I had a crisis of conscience. And I thought, we shouldn't be doing this. And so they're supposedly creating these new protocols to, what they have to do in order to obtain permission or whatever, grant themselves permission to secretly surveil people. And what immediately occurred to me is that's effectively no rule of law. If it's up to the conscience of a guy like Eric Holder, if that's the only resort that you have, if that's what oversight amounts to, then it's done. That hot dog is fried. Because I don't trust that guy an inch.
Right, but the whole point is that we shouldn't be in a position to have to trust that guy.
Exactly right. It's the same as these FISA courts are all these conservative, like they're 18 of the 19 or whatever, 9 of the 10, are these neocon judges. And they're supposed to be, really? That's what we have to do? We have to have faith in that in order to protect our privacy? So I read the other day that this is the quote-unquote golden age of spying because of all this digital stuff. And so, as a journalist, I just got an email from a colleague this week about having to set up a VPN or virtual private network. Unfortunately for me, I'm like a technophobe or whatever, techno idiot. But I'm going to try to do it. I'm going to take this more seriously because it definitely does feel like every time you click your mouse or send an email or talk on your cell phone, you are providing people the means with which to sort of really control you.
I mean, do you have any doubt, right? I mean, so much of your stuff must be being surveilled at this point.
Well, I try not to inhabit like the paranoid point of view, but yeah, it feels like that. I know that immediately after 9/11, you know, when I was living in Brooklyn, I could never get a proper phone line because I went over and wrote about Hezbollah. I was writing about Bush's religious life, Tom DeLay. I just was taking up subject matters that were, you know, it felt to me like God, you know, and they're listening, and I'm sure they were, and I'm sure they are on some level at least. I don't pretend that I'm, you know, target number one or anything, but yeah, it feels like a violation, and it feels more like gratuitous than anything else. Like, I don't have things to hide per se, but that's not freedom. You know, the Josh Marshall idea of this stuff is, well, you know, hey, you know, it's okay by me if they're watching me because I got nothing to hide. Well, what kind of flimsy, pathetic freedom is that? You know, that, you know, you're only as free as, like, you, as long as you're not threatening anybody with power.
Yeah,
you know, that's not.
And the point is that this Committee to Protect Journalists piece shows, report shows, is that it is chilling reporting. I mean, that, you know, the bottom line is it's both on the reporting end and in particular on the sort of the government source end. It is chilling essentially the people's ability to know what is going on things that have nothing to do with national security, or if, you know, if this gets out, we're all going to die.
The context for that, Sam, is it's chilling what is already pretty deeply refrigerated journalism.
Right.
You know, journalism has been in a sub-zero refrigerator freezer probably
for some
considerable time.
And I got to think as well that it, you know, at a time where you see the contraction of the journalism business, it becomes even worse, right? Because then there's always hanging over you your career trajectory. There's always hanging over your job security. I mean, I got to think that just exacerbates it, the situation, because obviously, I mean, if you're worried about losing your job, if you're worried about losing your access and not being able to do your job in one context, it becomes obviously much worse if there's just not that many jobs out there.
Yeah, I mean, and it goes further than that. So, you know, a lot of times the most important and interesting journalism reporting is from outsiders, or from, and particularly younger people who aren't like trading on access and aren't, you know, pals with the people they're reporting on, who, you know, have a kind of more objective or adversarial relationship with power. And, you know, those people, their mediums that they're reporting through are being thrown in doubt as even if it's even journalism, you know. So, you know, they could be threatened with prison because they're not, you know, they don't even have what basic kind of protections as someone at the Cincinnati Bugle would, you know. It's not just that the chilling effect is implicating, you know, establishment journalists. It's also, you know, making it, you know, more difficult for outsiders to find a point of view without, you know, possibly, you know, facing prosecution.
Right. Well, I want to talk, we only have a couple minutes here left. We were going to talk a little bit more about this, because, you know, this obviously the debt ceiling thing, the government shutdown, literally, I mean, I think the President Obama is meeting with some Republican senators right now. I happen to think that this is also one of those things that where we see the political reporting all focused on the political fortunes of the players involved here, as opposed to the agendas that are at play. I mean, we hear about the Republicans having no agenda, and on some level, I don't think that they do. I think theirs are much more tied into the political fortune, but I think we hear very little analysis of, you know, what is the motivation of the administration? What is their agenda in this? And what is the agenda of Senate Democrats in this? And we're not seeing a lot of it. And obviously the news is moving pretty fast. But it is, you know, some of this stuff just gets obnoxious on some level. But
the horse race stuff is sort of is what it is. You know, from my point of view, what I, you know, as a Canadian.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
What I see, what
can
I see
you get
in this,
me citizenship?
What I see in this is like, this is a, I think, pretty lame, but still an attempt to rationalize and universalize health care in this country. And, you know, it happens that my father was involved in that process in Canada in the 1960s. And people think, oh, Canada's got this health care system. And, you know, Canadians are either they like it or they don't or whatever. But the fact of the matter is it came with a big fight. The doctor, in Canada's case, the doctors went on strike and refused to see patients, which was an amazing thing when you think about it. And what happened was that like thousands of doctors flew in from the United Kingdom and elsewhere, and some from the United States, and began to treat patients. And that's what sort of crushed that. But the way I sort of see it is that this last-ditch, desperate effort to stop something that changes the nature of the relationship between, you know, citizen and health. And so, you know, it's not ironic to me. It's kind of like classic to me that this whole thing would be, you know, I believe that there's a lot more at work than we've seen in terms of, like, the people that are funding and the real causes for this. Because, you know, when Ted Cruz gets up, who's Canadian, that's the irony I was going to say. He's a Canadian-born guy, the Texan senator. He gets up and he does this ridiculous speech. He gives, like, this 24-hour right. filibuster. And it makes no sense, but, you know, the guy's like double Princeton or whatever he is. You know, he's using a nonsensical tactic to do something that is perfectly rational, you know, which is to undo the last election and undo the law. So, you know, that's how I see it. It's just this is you know, what desperate people do when they're losing. So on that level, you got to praise Obama. He doesn't know how to win a fight, I got to say.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I am skeptical. Well, let me put it this way. And this is, you know, this gets back down. We're circling back to the notion of questioning assumptions. I think what is just greatly overlooked by the establishment political reporters is what is he trying to win? And I just...
Is he Obama or he Cruz?
I'm talking about Obama. And I just think that, like, he has stated time and time again what his agenda is. The administration has come out time and time again, and their agenda is to get entitlement reform. And this is another one of those situations where I think they went into this, they didn't know what was going to happen. We're here in part because of the sequester was a failed political device, essentially, to force the parties to the table to create a crisis point wherein entitlement reform could come out of it. That failed.
You think he's after Medicaid and Medicare kind of thing?
Well, I don't even have to think. I mean, Google Obama advisor statement entitlement reform. I mean, you know, it's out there. We've seen those statements repeated multiple times just in the past couple of weeks. And it started, you know, with talk of the grand bargain before they were inaugurated. This is the agenda. I definitely think that in President Obama's bucket list, entitlement reform is something that's going to lead to is a checkoff box on the legacy to-do list. And
well, he's always said that Ronald, he admired and emulated Ronald Reagan, so. You know, that would not surprise me. I mean, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but yeah, you know, sure.
And so I think winning for him is to get the Republican Party to a point where they are willing to accept any type of revenue increase so that he could sell this to the left. The revenue increases are going to be in closing tax loopholes as opposed to new taxes, because loopholes can always be unraveled quite easily and quite quietly because it's far more complicated and far less sexy than anything else gets its attention. And he'll come out of this with that chain CPI on Social Security or whatever it is, some entitlement reform that can be paraded around just like Bill Clinton's welfare reform, which in many respects
was a good move,
disaster.
Going after the poor and the wealthiest time in history. You know, it's funny. I wrote a book about a cop, organized crime a cop, called The Brotherhoods. And that might be becoming a movie. And I have Arms and the Dudes is moving along as well, and so is Octopus. We'll see. But this cop had a saying, which I always think is like a very interesting way to think about things, which is he was a very talented detective. He said, you know, if you see somebody doing something that makes no sense, then you just haven't thought about it enough. So, if you know, applying that logic to your point of view, it's like you know, if this fight appears to be so nonsensical as it does, right, as it's basically being covered as, like, you know, two children holding their breath or whatever, this horse race, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe there actually is, because, I mean, are these people idiots? It sure seems like it, but maybe not. You know, maybe this is all like some great big kabuki play being enacted for our benefit, and then all, you know, next thing you know, you know.
I think that's pretty close. I mean, frankly, I think that's pretty close. You know, the reality may be that the Republicans are losing this battle, but they are winning the war. You know, we're now
arguing. They have been for decades, right? They have been for decades.
Yes, and we're now arguing over whether or not they're going to open the government at levels of operation in terms of a budget that is far closer to the Ryan budget than it is to anything that the Democrats in the Senate offered or President Obama. And they were coming in having already pre-negotiated supposedly with themselves. So I'm just not as...
It's by analogy, the national security analogy to that is the debate in the United States now is, you know, should we bomb Syria? Not, does the United States have the right to go around bombing countries? It's like, should we bomb this country or that country? Like, that's a debate that's already been lost.
Yeah. All right. Well, Guy, I appreciate the time today.
Don't cheerful, man, right?
No,
hold on.
Well, this is the way I end every show now. It's just sort of every interview I have now is just like, sorry, everybody.
But you promised that. I'm at 268 Facebook likes.
Yes. I was just, this is where I was going, buddy. All right. Listen, folks. Guy, as he said, is a technophobe. He's so much of a tech newbie. He doesn't even know what to call himself.
Right.
And so we're going to put a link to his Facebook page. He was at 268. I gave him a full on guarantee that he would bust through past 270 of likes after his appearance here. So we're going to put a link up on majority.fm to his Facebook page and his Twitter handle, which is some like derivation of Guy Lawson. We don't know what it is, right?
I don't even know. No, I don't know. But I promise to put up interesting posts and stuff for people. Especially, I'll be concentrating on arms dealing and national security in the coming months.
And people should go back. We'll link obviously to Rolling Stone and some of your pieces on the Mexican drug cartels. You've done wonderful reporting all around the globe, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And a happy Canadian Thanksgiving or whatever it is you guys celebrate.
Yeah, it's Canadian Thanksgiving. Thanks for that, Sam, and it's really a pleasure to talk to you, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Guy Lawson, everybody. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, my understanding is he's waiting in the hallway. Matthew Film Guy will be joining us in just a moment. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know that every week I bring in someone who gives us a, not into the studio, of course, but I bring someone on the program to give us a Netflix or some type of streaming a movie recommendation because, as I explained to Michael today, not only do I not go out to see movies, I don't even get a chance to see ads for movies. So he's talking about, like, have you seen, what was it, Gravity?
Joe Stevens?
Yeah, I don't remember what it was. And I'm like,
Joe Stevens, Sam, that's what it was.
I haven't even heard of these.
Blockbuster.
Movies. What was the movie that you said? That
Joe Stevens.
No, come on.
Captain Phillips.
Captain Phillips. I haven't even heard of these.
I was going to guess Don John, but Joe Stevens from Captain
Wait, what's Don John?
It's the one with Joseph Gordon-Levitt where he's like the
Who's
porn
Who's Joseph
addict.
Gordon-Levitt?
Oh, my God.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Honestly,
that's an honorable thing to say.
I have no idea.
Sam likes using pop culture references like the woods are dark and deep. I have no idea what he's talking about.
That was actually really because the other day
we almost
pulled some sound of some minister talking about why Madonna was possessed by the devil. And we were joking like, oh, that's hilarious. All of his references are out of date. And then I was like, wait a second. The hypocrisy of Sam to go after this guy for attacking Madonna. Are you kidding me?
Well, but the point is I'm not going to say like, folks, this is just like the same thing as the dynamic with this very popular Madonna girl.
Sam's more relevant.
I don't use that to.
He would have used Tiffany.
Right.
You've used
I don't know who that is.
The Hilton sisters before, I think.
Hold on. Can you hear him? Is he coming
up? I can hear him.
Am I on?
Yeah, he's on.
Okay.
Maybe you can't.
All right.
Hear.
Well, let me properly introduce you.
Sure.
But I can't do that without the theme song. Of course, today it's Matthew Film Guy's Day. He got bumped last week. I'm not going to lie for Randy Credico.
You don't have to mention it either.
All right. Well, it's always best not to mention it. But he is in studio with us. It's very exciting. It's been a while. You're looking good. But here's the theme song.
Rocket.
Turn it down. Yeah, we do actually have a camera.
Oh. You can now see Michael and myself.
Yes, on the Sammy Cam is no longer really just the Sammy Cam. We have two cameras going back and forth now. And so as a film guy, I know you might appreciate that. I noticed as we were setting you up in studio, you don't really have a sense of blocking. You just took the spot that was completely blocked you by the... By the audio boom. How are you, Matthew?
I come from the school where the camera follows the actors. I was trying to step up the
relationship.
Okay, in this instance, we're in the school where the
actor needs to speak into the mic. That's the school that we're at.
Hello.
There you go.
You can't. We're not. I don't have a
microphones that I have go more than 6 inches. So
yeah, you got to talk into it. You want to just like
no, that's not necessary.
Move the not necessary. Thing so that it's facing into your yeah, like that maybe, that might work. Try that. I know. It's a little bit hectic.
Hello?
There we go.
Now, Matthew.
Hello?
Yes. Hello.
Okay. Begin.
Matthew.
Are you trying to, like, show mumblecore to us during this interview?
Yes. Oh, well, yeah. Why don't you explain what mumblecore is?
You know, it's whatever's. I mean, because. And you don't, because. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's like really, it's really annoying David Mamet.
I mean, Mamet is sculpted. You know, mumblecore was a joke word. It was not meant to signify anything real. You know, it was given to a couple low-budget movies where the sound was maybe not, or maybe was much like this.
Right. And like a funny ha-ha, right? That was one of those.
That's sometimes quoted as the original mumblecore film.
Is that really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is probably the last one you are aware of, right?
That is exactly right, actually.
It's actually one of the best ones.
One of the Jaraki? Was it Jaraki?
No, Bujalski.
Bujalski, yes. Yeah. Okay, I get those two confused.
Yeah.
Because they have brothers. Aren't they both brothers?
You're thinking of the Duplass brothers?
No.
Those are the only mumblecore brothers I can think of.
All right, so the mumblecore is like what the millennial set does, right?
Yeah. It's like the latest wave of DIY independent films.
Okay.
All of which, to a man, all the directors call that have sort of distanced themselves from that word. It's sort of a marketing buzzword that means nothing.
Okay, fair enough. And so it worked for a while, in other words.
Yeah.
And then they abandoned it.
Film festival programmers.
There was a time we called it Dogma 95, was it? Or was it...
Yeah, you could call that a kind of a spiritual ancestor.
Right, okay. I mean, Dogma... The Dogma thing, I thought, at the time, from a marketing standpoint, was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, and it was devised as such by those crazy Danish guys.
Yeah, and I wish we had thought of it when we did Who's the Caboose.
You probably fulfilled most of the Dogma, except for, like, non-diegetic music. Probably fulfilled most of their laws.
Oh, yeah, and we made the music seem diegetic. That is that it's recorded concurrently with the action.
Right. It's like playing in the scene, not soundtrack.
Right. But that's right. For Who's the Caboose, we did a lot of that. And had we known, we would have done it. But what we should have done is written our own Dogma.
Set of laws, yeah.
But we didn't do that. The only thing I did from a marketing standpoint was when we went to the Aspen Comedy Festival, I sent out fake faxes saying that the mountain was shut down during the hours that the movie was playing. And apparently the Denver Post reported it. Unironically, they didn't realize that it was a lie.
Nice. And didn't you also give yourself a fake award for that one?
Well, fake award is really, that's a questionable.
Right, you created the award and you granted it to yourself. It was a real award, though.
I mean, we were fortunate because the guys who sat on the board of the award happened to also be the guys who made the film. I'm fully happy to concede that probably gave us the inside track, but
sure.
I think that we made a fair assessment. Yeah,
I trust you to judge yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, we awarded ourselves the coveted Black Diamond Award,
which is the hardest award to go down.
It is the hardest award to go down. It's the hardest award to get. If you're not us. Because
yeah, because no one else was getting that award.
How many other films got to receive that award?
It is that's what made it so coveted and prestigious. Only one film has ever gotten that.
To this day. Undefeated.
Wow.
And we put in an ad in Variety during the festival, reminding people that we got the award. That phone is heard in the mic.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it is. A lot of congratulations from people. And the guy who ran the film festival at the time said, what is this? And I was like, oh, it's the Black Diamond Award that's given to a movie that is playing in the Aspen Comedy Festival, but is awarded by an entity outside of the festival. And he liked it after that. I mean, at first he was pissed, but then he started realizing that it was actually bringing credibility to the festival that they had an award to give out. And
sort of the nature of awards in general.
Yes. I mean, that was the one thing I realized. Like, this is, and to this day, you can look at the press that we got for Who's the Caboose. I mean, it was, you know, 15, 20 years ago now. But people said, like, they're the winners of the prestigious Black Diamond Award. And I was like, yeah, you bet your ass we are.
Nice.
I think like we even that. Put it on the...
It's great.
Yeah, well,
if you Google Black Diamond Award, Who's the Caboose, it shows up all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Everything I've ever read about it.
It always says the prestigious.
Well, because that's actually part of the name of the award.
Yeah.
The official name of the award is the Prestigious Black Diamond Award.
Smart. Smart marketing.
It was sort of a classic thing for me because I got nothing out of it.
You got this last 5 minutes. That was great.
Yeah. No, I mean, I basically did it so that someday I could have a podcast, have you in, not let you speak and tell the story.
Let me set it up. Yeah. So it's worth.
Well,
it's
Matthew, it was great having you here. That was a great story about the prestigious Black Diamond Award. Thank you so much for showing up today.
Anytime.
So let's get to... Oh. What is there something interesting that you want to tell me?
You mean not about you?
Yeah, I mean, is there anything else? Anything, Marin?
No,
anything?
No. let's not talk about Marin. Let's not talk about his new Netflix 1-hour comedy special.
What? Are you serious? When did that happen?
No, let's not talk about it.
When did that happen?
I don't know. He shot it a few months ago, and
it
just came out like this
Netflix.
Week. Yeah.
That's interesting. Are they doing that regularly?
I don't know.
Wow.
He doesn't tell me anything anymore.
I know.
Is it because of this?
I don't think so. But he doesn't even tell me if that's the case.
Because he's talking to you.
Oh, no, no.
No, I mean, I've chatted with him, so it's not like he's blacklisted me. But
yeah, no, he's too successful now
to
talk about his success.
Yeah, he got Lance Bangs to direct the comedy special, so.
Who's that?
I defer to him. Never mind. Google him.
All right. Now, Matthew. Well,
I didn't want to get into that. I don't want to talk about the guy that Mark hired over me, so, you know.
Yeah, that was obnoxious, wasn't it?
No. Lance Bangs is a serious guy. He's, you know, he does a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff.
You are nothing if not a serious guy, Matthew.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate that. You have fine taste, may I say.
I like how the two guys who used their full given name.
This guy's made music videos for Sonic Youth, Nirvana. Yeah, you aren't getting
it.
Yeah,
I defer to Lance Bangs.
We shot a one of those sort of greeting cards together.
You and he?
No, you and I.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So I don't know why that doesn't. All right, now, Matthew.
That's right.
Last week, or I should say last month when you were on.
Yeah.
You recommended a film called...
Was it Mean Time was the last one I recommended?
I do not remember.
Was there one after that?
I feel like there's one after that because... wait a second. I looked for Mean Time.
Yeah, you gave me some crap about it not being on.
And then you reminded me that it was on YouTube.
Right.
Now it's all coming back to me. But I think last time you recommended a different film, didn't he?
Yeah, I did, but I'm drawing a blank, too.
Why don't we have, Michael, why don't we have an aggregate source of the films?
Mommy and Daddy are fighting again.
Come on.
What? People ask
for that. It's in the post. That's the whole thing. You can find it in the post.
You got to use the word movie.
I usually have them all written down, but I must have winged it last time.
Hold on one moment.
All right. Well, meantime, I didn't see it.
Yeah, I figured.
You know what I did watch the other night, though?
Do tell.
I watched World War Z.
And?
Eh.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is I've never seen a zombie movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's an interesting one to start with.
Well, I would like to very much have this conversation right now, as you know me. The film you recommended last was How to Make Money Selling Drugs.
Oh, yeah. The documentary.
That's not on Netflix, though.
Isn't it? It was on Amazon.
You also recommended What Maisie Knew.
Oh, okay. Yeah, What Maisie Knew.
I'm sorry, buddy.
As fun as flirting with Isabel, I know.
Back to the World War Z. Back to World War Z. So you liked it, Sam?
Well, wait a second. What Maisie Knew.
I'll just sit back.
What Maisie Knew. And you got to move your phone, buddy. And what was the other one?
Ever since you first checked it, it's been making noises.
Selling drugs.
This. I'll turn it off.
I'm going to watch those. But the problem is, this is what happened. Usually what I do is I watch a movie on Saturday night after the kids are asleep and also after Nikki goes to sleep. Mm. And but last Saturday night, Mila wanted to watch Harry Potter because she read the first book. She's halfway through the second book. And we reluctantly agreed that she could because she's just so excited about it. She cried after that movie for 48 hours straight.
Oh, no.
Because of the orphan aspect of it. She's very sensitive about
wanting to be one or that it's sad.
Well, as much as she vows to make my life miserable, and she does vow that. An 8-year-old sensitive about the things. But
yeah, they need parents, I hear.
So then I was exhausted, but I was like, I don't have time to watch a movie. I'm going to fall asleep. But then I just watched that Z movie, and it was, I think the last zombie movie I saw was the one with the Nazis, like 30 years ago.
What was the one with the Nazis?
Where they come out of the water, the zombie Nazis. I can't remember what that was.
That's like a straight-to-DVD movie. I've seen it. I don't remember the name of it, though.
I don't even know if it's straight-to-DVD, because it was made before.
Straight to VHS.
Made before DVD.
Straight to VHS, then, I mean.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't even know that one. I enjoyed World War Z just as a, you know, it was creepy, and it made my friend I went and saw it with jump out of a seat about 2 feet at one part. So that was
I imagine if you see it on a big screen. Yeah. I watch it basically on something the size of an iPad.
Yeah.
But I realized that Saul, my son, is like a zombie. He just rolls around. He rolls over stuff. He doesn't know where he's going. He's just going, and then tries to eat your hand.
And he's eating your brains too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you mad that I didn't watch these movies?
No, not at all. It's all the same to me. I've given up on you actually watching the recommendations. Now it's more for the folks at home and listening to this podcast.
You sound mad.
That's just how I sound. No, I'm not mad.
How does that affect your relationship?
Makes me mad.
Does it? Tone. No, I mean, do you take it personally? I hope not.
No, not at all.
He takes it personally. I can tell.
He wants me to take it personally.
Sounds personal to me, and I'm usually got your side on these things, buddy.
What sounds personal?
If you didn't watch, I couldn't even think of what they were. So this week's one is really good, and I think you're going to like it a lot.
All right. What is it?
So it's the Iranian film that won the Oscar.
What?
Iranian film.
Iranian film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Iranian? Michael, help us out here.
You have some nerve to be telling people how to say words.
No, all right. So the Iranian film.
Or Iranian film.
All right.
They're both good. And it won the Golden Globe and the Oscar in 2012.
All right,
whatever that's worth.
No way. Dude, the Golden Globe is in the bag. The Oscar is BS.
Right. I assume so. But just as a historical note, it was one of the first Iranian films to win the best foreign film. So that's somewhat significant to the extent that I give any credence to the Oscars or the Golden Globes.
Okay.
But the movie is actually very good. It's by get all my notes going here. It's by a director named Asghar Farhadi, and it's an Iranian film. What's interesting about it is that it was done without the funding of the Iranian culture ministry, even though it was at first blocked because the director spoke out in favor of Moshe Makhmalbaf, you know that guy, and Jafar Pahani, he's the filmmaker who was put under house arrest.
Okay.
So they tried to mess with the film, but the production license was initially blocked because he spoke out for those guys. And in any case, it's a very morally complex, as they are wont to be, tale that revolves around ostensibly around a couple wanting to get divorced. I know that was like what my last one was too, but it's because the woman wants
really
to leave Iran.
Really push the divorce thing.
It's, I don't know, it makes for a compelling story, but it's sort of just the sort of beginning of the story because the woman wants to leave Iran feeling kind of, kind of oppressed there.
Right.
The implication is politically, but they never quite say it. And the husband wants to stay to take care of his ailing father who has Alzheimer's, which is rendered extremely poignantly and harrowingly, actually, his dealing with Alzheimer's. And their 10-year-old daughter is sort of caught in the middle, which you might find pretty compelling. And I don't want to give it away, but there's a major incident that occurs near the beginning of the movie that basically tests the family, as well as you, as you're watching it, and your understanding of the integrity of the parents and who's telling the truth and what really happened. And it's actually a very Iranian film, or Iranian film.
It's called A Separation,
that's right.
Okay. A Separation?
A Separation, yeah.
Now, wait a second. What does it make it a very Iranian film? I mean, other than I assume everybody in it is Iranian.
Well, because it deals with a lot of the sort of trappings of Iranian society, such as how men and women relate, how they can't touch each other, how they have to consult their religious leaders to do certain things, and also how the legal system works there, which I was totally ignorant of. And it's actually really interesting. It's sort of honor-based. Like, they don't have a lot of lawyers. They're sort of in a room with, like, a judge. And they kind of let you out on your own recognizance to get witnesses and things. That was very fascinating. And it also deals with the kind of the class distinctions that are there that I wasn't necessarily aware of how those work. And it's also kind of like a Rashomon kind of film, you know, that it's like who's telling the truth. You see it from different perspectives and you're switching back and forth. And, you know, you're kind of switching who you're with and who you're disappointed by. And anyway, the filmmaking style is very controlled. It's a bit austere in that kind of neo-realist way that the Iranians like to do. You know,
oh, yeah. No music, no trick shots. In that neo-realist way, the way the Iranians like to do. Yeah, okay.
Didn't I just say that?
Yeah. They sort of got that mumblecore thing going, too. Is that what you're saying?
I can't tell because they're mumbling in Farsi, so I don't, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, it's nothing but solid performances and it has
elements. How do you know?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. Sometimes I wonder if you can really tell the acting in a foreign film. But
that's why I think like a lot of crappy movies from this country do well in other places. Because if you don't know, if you don't know, if you're not a native speaker, you can't. I mean, audio is so the way that someone sounds when they speak reveals so much more than I think that we're conscious of.
Yeah, like for instance, no, never mind.
Wait, what are you talking about? What were you going to say?
I was going to say, like, if you detect a note of condescension in someone's voice.
Well, I mean, if the shoe fits, Matthew.
Anyway, this movie, it also has, like, stalker elements, like a thriller. It's got a lot of different stuff in it. And anyway, I love this movie. It was compelling from beginning to end. Thank you. And the tension between the kid identifying with the mother and father and who she's sort of with changes back and forth. And it actually has one of the greatest end credit sequences in any movie I've ever seen.
Wow.
Where you're gripped the entire time.
Wow.
And actually just today, the Iranian Cultural Ministry just nominated his new movie for the Oscar for this year, which they hadn't done before.
What do you do? Have a Google alert on this guy or what? I mean, how do you know this
guy? I do a little research before I come on here.
All right.
And it just so happens. Interesting.
It's an interesting signal. It came out this morning. That's totally legitimate.
It's sort of in keeping with the whole cultural outreach.
Part of Rouhani's like outreach.
So a guy who did his first movie sort of...
this isn't his first movie, but
his most recent movie, outside of the normal funding process,
because
he was on their shit list.
Right. Make a note.
Yeah, we can say that at this time.
Okay.
is now being embraced.
Yeah. Which is sort of interesting to me because the Iranian film for the last 20, 25 years has been like some of the greatest world cinema. And it sort of like goes back to that, the cuckoo clock speech from Third Man. Did you know that one? Orson Welles gives that speech about how Italy was through war and devastation all those years and oppression. And they came up with some of the greatest art and literature ever. And Switzerland was always peaceful and open. And they only came up with the cuckoo clock. So it's sort of interesting to see what this sort of new cultural revolution, so to speak, might actually do to the Iranian film industry.
I think it's got a long way to go before that sort of edge is taken off. It's interesting. What is interesting, though, is to see how that type of stuff is a political statement, not just domestically, but also internationally. I mean, I was far more conscious of this about Cuba because obviously, I guess almost over 10 years ago, Nikki, my wife, shot a documentary in Cuba. We all went down there. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to talk to artists and the photographers to see, sort of how much breath they had, far more latitude because the Cuban government wanted them to be representatives of the society. So they had far more latitude. In many respects, it was sort of more of like a propaganda thing, but...
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm wondering about, what they're going to approve, because they still had to approve this movie. They still had to give it a license. They still had their hand in it, even though they weren't funding it. So they're still, it's a much more controlled system than we have here. Or maybe you could just say in a different way, less commercial, more sort of religious or political.
Yes. Here, it's just if this isn't a huge steaming pile of crap, there's no way it's going to happen.
No, it's not. There's no chance.
I mean, I've heard good things about that one, that John Ridley movie. Have you heard that? What is it?
Don John?
No.
Oh.
I can't remember. I don't know what it is. I just know Ridley because I saw him on Hayes the other night, Chris Hayes' show.
What's that one?
Chris Hayes?
No, the other. John Ridley?
John Ridley. He's a screenwriter, but he was an executive producer on a sitcom I did. He also was a scab.
You're talking about 12 Years a Slave?
Yes. He wrote 12 Years a Slave. And he was also a scab during the WGA strike. Ooh. And that was no good.
Did Hayes bring that up?
No. Mm. No.
That's the difference between Sam and Hayes.
Sam
might have brought that up. There's another Iranian movie that came out several years ago called Behind the Veil, and I think that was that one was allowed to go through when Khatami, who was the last reformist, was president. And it's really interesting because you kind of it's very subtle, but you realize that these women are prostitutes, basically, as the movie progresses. But it's just like this process.
Spoiler alert.
It's not that. Jesus.
All right.
The point is that there's a lot of interesting flexibility in Iranian filmmaking.
And this
that
particular
you
film,
expect.
It, he's not necessarily... you know, a radical. He clearly loves his country. He feels for it. And he's sort of the father character is sort of a stand in for him. It's sort of like the metaphor that he doesn't want to leave and flee the problems. He wants to stay and take care of it, even if it's sort of sick and has issues. And, it's subtle. It's not a polemic. It's about these people. It's about universal questions. And, I think you're really going to like it. And you could watch it with Nikki too. It's not like a, you know,
you should definitely watch it with Nikki. Clearly,
I'm just saying you should watch it with Nikki.
Okay, of course. Fair enough. I will do so. Well, Matthew, I'm impressed as always. I'm not necessarily going to watch it. I would like to.
I'd be impressed if you did.
I'd like to have the time to watch it.
Don't make me mad, Sam.
I might. Who knows? I might be able to watch it this weekend.
Great. You'll like it.
Maybe I'll watch it tonight.
Well, everyone out there, you should watch it too. It's actually not on Netflix. It's streaming on iTunes and Amazon.
What did you think about Breaking Bad?
I love that show. I was gripped.
Spoilers.
I was gripped. I love that. Seriously. No spoilers. Are you kidding me? I'm a complete believer in the no spoilers. I loved it. It, you know, whether the ending was you satisfying to you or not, I was happy. And
did you see? I mean, can we talk about this without it spoiling? The there is a theory out there that the ending.
Yeah. No. Don't. I wouldn't even try it. I don't agree with that theory. I think it's a cop-out to address that. But I also realize that it's a TV show. So if it had a sort of more down, so to speak, ending, it might have been more kind of have more sort of internal sort of consistency. But it wouldn't have been enjoyable. It wouldn't have been
as satisfying.
Yeah. So I'm, you know, for a TV show, I know there's a lot of talk about TV being the sort of new cinema. But still, for a TV show where you're with a character every week for an hour, I don't want it to be just too sort of downbeat. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, the point being that there's a theory out there that reinterprets. I'm not going to say what it is, but
okay.
Reinterprets the ending. I mean, people can go and Google it if you want.
Yeah.
They reinterpret the end. The whole episode.
Yeah, I
is
know.
Reinterpreted
from a certain moment in the car.
Yes,
I understand.
In that respect, it sort of gives people, you know,
the best of both worlds.
The best of both worlds.
Sure, if that
you want to believe that version,
right?
You can believe that version.
I think I just watch a TV show like that for a different reason
than
I go to the movies.
Did you think that series got good until I didn't think it really got good until like the fourth and fifth year?
Well, I always thought your criticism was sort of valid that the characters were a little bit sort of one dimensional, but it was such a great plot show.
Yes.
That for a TV show, just turning over the plot, not being afraid to let things happen and change the sort of pieces on the board.
Yeah. Everything,
that,
yes.
For that alone, it's awesome. It's not The Wire. It's not even Battlestar Galactica. It's not some of these other shows that I personally feel are better.
The Walking Dead.
Not The Sopranos even. Although The Sopranos had that plot element too.
I thought you were going to be like, no, shut up.
Yeah, no, shut up.
The Sopranos had that plot element, but I felt that the characters were just a little bit more richly drawn, frankly.
Who?
The Sopranos.
One
of the amazing things about
that
was that it was on one level, it felt like it could always easily be cartoonish.
Right.
But it was so grounded in what I really perceived as real emotion.
Yeah, I think so too. And you know, it sort of created the mold for this sort of TV show of the anti-hero in a lot of ways. So it's a high bar to meet as far as that goes. But you know, there's still a contingent of people who watched it just to see who got whacked every week, you know. So
I think actually it was the opposite. I think in The Sopranos it got more like that as it went on.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Breaking Bad got a little bit better as it went on.
Mm-hmm.
Like I agree. I don't think The Sopranos ever really fell off, but I felt like more like that in like the fourth season of The Sopranos where it was getting to like the, all right, who are they going to kill?
Yeah.
I didn't really see that the first couple of seasons.
Yeah, I think so too. It set up the world a lot better in the first four seasons.
Well, this has been very edifying and always a pleasure.
By the way, Matt, are you doing any Comic-Con stuff? Are you that kind of guy?
I was going to, but I won't be able to this time around.
Yeah, I've never been, so I thought you would.
What is there, Comic-Con in town?
Yeah, New York this week.
This weekend.
Really?
Why aren't you doing it?
In fact, right outside the office, when I was walking to work today, I was passed by three guys completely dressed as Gambit from X-Men, Deadpool, and Doctor Doom.
Wow.
Why aren't you doing anything?
Just going to be busy this weekend.
Well, what is there, a WWR thing?
WWR? You really are out of it. It was never even called WWR, ever.
Yeah, Madonna's having a concert.
All right. Well, Matthew, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can hang out if you want. I want to do a couple of
I'm not leaving.
Stories. You should probably fix the video. So
I'll move over.
I'll take some IMs in the meantime. Matthew's trying to wile his way in here. We know how that goes. Let's go to the IMs. Bush and Chains, we're in an economic recovery. Why are major corporations firing thousands? Why hasn't the Keynesian trickle-down crumbs from the Bernanke's million-trillion-dollar fiat printing had an effect? Surely this fund... Well, I mean, because our... I would imagine, one, it is not the most efficient way to deliver that money. And two, because we have fiscal contraction. Come on, you know that. Kubascore. This is the quote from Megyn Kelly in an interview in her new show. I've never wanted to be an opinion host. I don't think I'd be very successful anyway. I'm not an ideologue. I think you have to be successful in a primetime opinion-based show. I think I'm too moderate and reasonable. Now, that is laughable. Ian Longstong, taser rabbis, get Bush and Chain some Valium. He's scared enough of Jewish people who don't have less than lethal arms. Sammy Kammer. Okay, we got your message. I think that may just be you. Scanner. Guy Lawson was fantastic once again. Please get him on again. Matt Marr. Sam, next month is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. Are you going to do a show on the subject? Do you agree with Tom Hartman and Lamar Waldron that it was the mafia that killed JFK? You know, I got to be honest with you. I don't have any strong feelings on what was involved. I am always skeptical of sort of whatever the government story is. I do think the magic bullet theory is...
It was a lone gunman. Deal with it.
It's pretty stellar. I mean, I don't know if it was... I find it hard to believe it was just one guy who just took it upon himself to do this.
One dude.
Yeah.
Michael was there.
It was Barack Obama.
Umar's. Can you explain one more time how the conflict between Obama's goals of de-weaponizing, budget passing, and debt ceiling raising, and cutting Social Security in a way that the left thinks he was forced to do it can be resolved? Let me put it this way. Right now, there are sort of competing... I read something today that said that the Senate may be talking about a longer window. They want a longer continuing resolution and debt ceiling hike. They want to do it for 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is. President Obama has suggested that he would accept the six-week... And once that is done without any preconditions, he would negotiate. The more there is a condensed timeline and the further out it is from the 2014 elections, further away, the more there is an opportunity to create a crisis point where, look, we've got to get past this. There's more opportunity for the president to get out of it. Some type of process victory, i.e., not only are we going to raise the debt ceiling in 6 weeks, but we're also going to go to a McConnell rule, which says that the president can raise the debt ceiling and it can be reversed by two-thirds of the Senate. In that scenario, the president still needs to demand something in return for the entitlement reform that supposedly the Republicans want, but also he wants. He wants to have a deal like welfare reform, which you'll remember was done with a Republican Congress. And so he wants to come to some type of welfare reform agreement. The calculation is they cannot get it without some type of increase in revenues. And that's why he's already put on the table, I will accept loopholes closing. He can't get it without that, because there's no way that any Democrat could sign on without that. They shouldn't sign on even with it, frankly. So what he's going to bring, what he wants to come out of this negotiation with, is entitlement reform and de-weaponizing the debt ceiling for future generations. That's where they want to get to. They do not have a clear plan of how to get there. They couldn't, because nobody knows. There's so many moving pictures. I mean, so many moving parts. But the point is that's where you want to get to. So, you know, it's like, think about it as, I'm on Island A. I want to get to Island B. And you're sailing across whatever it is, this small sea, and storms come, or winds come and change their direction, and you tack your boat based upon those things so that you're always trying to get to that other shore. And that's what we're seeing now is taking place. Did that explain it? I don't know if that did it.
Sam, can you speculate how he gets there? Do you have any ideas how he gets there?
I've just said it.
But
he
creates
does a short-term window. He says, we've got 6 weeks to negotiate this. And he sits down and they figure out something that is sort of like palatable to the Republicans. Now,
like
cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare. Just because he wants it,
yeah,
doesn't mean that the Republicans don't want it too.
Right.
And then it's a question of, if the Republicans walk out of there saying, like, this is what President Obama wanted, we wanted some other, and they'll get some other type of tax cut.
Do you see, though, the two pitfalls?
I don't know that it's going to work, because I'm not quite convinced. You know, the dynamics now are different than they were 2 years ago,
exactly,
because President Obama's not running for re-election.
He's gone. So what is my incentive if I'm a Democratic congressperson to vote against the most popular, successful government program
ever?
Right.
And then jeopardize. And then Republicans,
well,
also,
your incentive,
aren't they endlessly right?
You have no incentive for it. In fact, you have a disincentive, but you also don't want to be seen as the guy who's holding up the deal and be responsible for us going through the debt ceiling. So the leverage here for that is that no one wants to be held responsible for holding up a deal. That's how you jam somebody. That's how you jam somebody. And this is why the leadership in the Senate in particular, but also in the House, for the Democrats, is so important, because Harry Reid can just say, we're not going to bring it up for a vote, period. End of story. That's it. I'm the one who's responsible for that. And then, you know, senators can hem and haw. They can lay low. They cannot talk about it. That's the strategy that's been taking place right now with this piecemeal stuff. And it's been working.
It's been working really well. And then I think the other possibility is just these people are so crazy, in the same way that they rejected a deal a couple of years ago that would have gone through, that was like 70% of what they wanted. They rejected it because it wasn't 100%.
One can hope.
That's also possible.
And that's why, on some level, look, the deal's not going to be made until the 11th hour, regardless of when that 11th hour is. If it's a six-week extension, it's going to be made in the sixth week. If it's a six-month extension, it's going to be made in the fourth week of the sixth month. The longer you draw this out, the more pain it's inflicting on the Republicans from a political standpoint, frankly.
And the more it's important to do with that woman who called yesterday, it was Heather from L.A., which is like, call your Democratic rep and sign petitions and get
and
out ahead of that.
The more time there is for progressive forces to get out ahead of any deal that would – that's why, if you want – I mean, look, it's the shock doctrine, right? If you want – if you go in and you think that you have an agenda that you want to push through – that is screwing the most amount of constituencies, the best time to do that is in a time of crisis, when it's a crisis. And, you know, the shorter the window, the greater the crisis that the negotiations will take place under. So that's the agenda. Let me do this story because it's just too funny. Well, it's not. I don't know if it's funny, really, frankly. It's sort of bizarre. Amongst Orthodox Jews, they're fundamentalists in many respects. And there are some modern Orthodox who are not fundamentalists. They don't believe that. They may not necessarily say that they don't think that the Jewish Bible, the Torah, is the word of God. But what they'll say is that, you know, it's like a roadmap. And there are times where you come onto the, you're looking at a roadmap and you're looking and you're saying, hey, there's a fork in the road here that isn't really sort of delineated in the roadmap. I'm going to choose here. Whereas, you know, the full-on fundamentalists say, everything that's written in here is cast in stone. It's never wrong. And if you find something on the ground that's different, then it's the ground that's wrong, not the text. That's the difference between fundamentalists and not. So apparently there was an ultra-Orthodox rabbi in Brooklyn. Yeah, the difference between Roberts and Scalia, maybe, arguably. The ultra-Orthodox in Brooklyn, there was a rabbi, Mendel Epstein, who apparently was the go-to guy when women wanted to divorce their husbands, where this guy would deliver. Because you have to, in this type of fundamentalism, of course, women are completely subjugated. And they're not allowed to say, I want a divorce and get it. The husband has to say, okay. And that's called a get, apparently. And so,
you know, it's called that.
This 68-year-old rabbi, apparently, would get referrals from other rabbis in the community. If a woman was saying, like, you know, my husband, he beats me, or my husband, he's a bad guy, or I don't like him, or, you know, like, you know, this is not working out for me. He will not give me a get. How can you help me, Rabbi? And he goes, I'll tell you who you got to go to. You got to go to Mendel Epstein. He's the best at getting the get.
He's the fixer.
He's the get. He's the gettest. Okay? So apparently, based upon a sting, and apparently there was like sort of urban legend about this or other reports of this. Apparently,
Michael loves this.
Federal undercover agents posing, or an agent posing as an Orthodox Jewish woman, went to Rabbi Epstein to get his services. And apparently what Rabbi Epstein does for anywhere from, this is unbelievable. He charges wives as much as $10,000 for a rabbinical decree permitting violence. And then $50,000 to hire his goon squad.
Well, specifically, they're called tough guys.
Tough guys. Tough guys.
The Golem Squad.
To kidnap the husband, put him in a van, drive him around, and tase him sometimes in the testicles.
Oof.
I think he also specifically told them not to leave a mark.
And
you may, you see.
And apparently this is the way this guy would secure the gets.
I would say so.
Yes. And at times, and apparently he told the undercover agent this. Even though there have been some people who, some victims who have come out and talked to the police, he says basically the reaction of the police is, if the guy doesn't have a mark on him, there's some Jewish crazy affair here, and they don't want to get involved.
I live in Brooklyn. I can relate to that.
And that's basically it. What's stunning is that they would go, and they would get a rabbinical, they'd hold their own rabbinical court with Rabbi Epstein and another Rabbi Walmark. They would have their own rabbinical court, which apparently you need two guys, but they would have all the legalisms and the formalisms. And they would say, in this case, we're going to decree that it's okay to use violence on this guy. And then Rabbi Epstein would get his tough guys to put somebody in a van and shock him until he got the get.
I love that they couldn't get a decree to let just the woman out of the marriage.
Right. Oh, no, that would, no.
They had to get the decree to mess up the guy who wouldn't give the woman.
Destroying
tradition. If you want to know what's wrong with fundamentalism, that's it in a nutshell. They can't get the decree to give women any type of rights. Only God could do that.
Yeah.
But we can get the decree to taser the guy's testicles to get him to give the
girl. Oh, it's just like, here, let me tell you this, honey. Here's what we can do. We obviously could not give you rights or agency. That's not going to happen.
Right, that's crazy.
What I can do is I can get a little exemption
Give a tase in the balls.
On the prohibition about tasing people's testicles.
Right, that's Leviticus.
In the name of doing what's right.
Yeah, we don't apply a strict scrutiny to that, if you will.
Oh, and I should say,
scrutiny.
It's not necessarily in the name of doing what's right. It's in the name of making a bunch of cash.
Right.
But Rabbi, you married us. What changed? $100,000.
You want $200,000? I could say that like you must not have a divorce.
I want to get to this story. It's an important story. You know, maybe we'll touch on it on Monday. But DeSmog Blog has a great piece up about a huge oil leak that has occurred in 20,000, over 20,000 barrels of oil fracked from the Bakken Shale. Has leaked. This is also according to Reuters. And the government, the public had no idea about it because of the government shutdown. That's a twofer. Oh, all right. Let's do this trucker story because this came up. I don't even know how to really.
Is this the convoy thing?
Yeah. It's so good.
Well, I mean, is it? Okay. I'm going to do this in a nutshell. Today was supposedly going to be the big day when all conservative truckers converge on Washington and they shut down the Beltway. All right. Just 3 days ago, we heard truckers ride for Constitution. Earl Conlon, a Georgia trucker who's handling logistics of the protest, told U.S. News tractor trailer drivers will circle the Beltway three lanes deep and they'll shut it down. Conlon says, we're not going to ask for impeachment. We're just going to ask for the arrest of all federal officials who don't follow the Constitution.
That's reasonable.
Zeta Andrews, a former country music singer helping to promote the protest, said last week participants would present demands to congressmen, including the impeachment. But like I say, Conlon backed off it. So then, yesterday, before the trucker convoy that was going to descend on Washington and everybody, okay, then Conlon says to the Washington Post that the whole protest is a hoax. Nothing gets the attention of the mainstream media like some sort of disastrous threat. In other words,
also they couldn't plan it. They couldn't get the truckers to pull through.
In other words, I effed up. It's never going to happen in the first place. It was a hoax on you the whole time. I'm not somebody who just completely talks out of the a-hole and doesn't know what they're doing. It was a hoax on you. And Pete Santelli, an internet radio host who's been serving as the official spokesman for the ride, said the trucker convoy is a photo off of the press and it's intended to spawn a larger outcry, an Egypt moment.
Ugh.
An Egypt moment?
We're looking for an Egypt moment where 100 million people get on the street and get on the roads and demand that our legislator follow the Constitution. But, of course, Conlon then said, looks like we're not going to get four people, so it's just a hoax. But then we hear from another spokesman. I mean, these people are just so insane. We hear from on Louisiana News, WAFB9, with protest co-organizer Zeta Andrews, that this is not a hoax, that it's real, there is a communication problem, and Earl Conlon has never been authorized as a spokeswoman. Andrews said, as a matter of fact, he's not even riding in the convoy.
Well, that's because it's a hoax.
And this goes back and forth. Now, who's telling the truth? Well, they're all just a pack of moron liars. But one should know that Zeta Andrews,
the one who says that it is happening,
that it is happening. And of course, now we know that it didn't happen unless we double hoaxed it. It's going to happen next Friday. She apparently, according to one of her YouTube comments that she left on a video about the Benghazi attack, she says that Barack Obama never existed. He is completely manufactured.
It's been Michael.
Now, we've heard that before, but of course, who manufactured him? Well,
this is obvious. Come on.
Osama bin Laden. In fact, it's simply Osama bin Laden's alter ego. She goes, the fact that these soldiers were set up to die in a no-return operation is obvious. They had knowledge that Obama didn't want leaked. Speaking about Benghazi.
Jesus Christ.
The Benghazi people obviously knew this. This is the SEALs that killed Osama bin Laden. I don't believe this story. He is alive. Call me crazy, but...
Okay.
Osama bin Laden is our President Obama. Do your research.
They always say that. Do your research.
Do your research.
Look it up.
Or she could be saying, or just do your research and see if I'm crazy. The CIA has been preparing for this since he was a boy.
Who is a boy? Bin Laden or Obama?
Since Bin Laden.
Obama doesn't exist.
Right. Obama's fictitious.
Obama's a fictitious character. But come on. Hey. They have the same height,
bone
structure, hands and ears.
They do
both
have hands and ears.
Are left-handed. The Osama face was created by Hollywood. The fox is in the hen house. Barack Obama never existed. Osama bin Laden did. Do your research.
I would love to enter this woman's mind. Like, I wonder what in her head, this how this played out.
It's clinical.
Like, it's like
you.
Bin Laden, like, workshopping the Obama voice.
Yeah. Hey, guys, check this out. Oh, look. There's not a red America and a blue America. There's the United States of America.
Well, that's very good, Osama.
Wallah Akbar. Oh, wait. See, I keep messing with that. It's supposed to be God Bless America.
Oh, God. That's disturbing.
Okay. Millington, I keep breaking guitar strings when I play Ted Nugent. Thanks, Obama. Piera, hello, Sam. I'm a listener from Portugal. Great show. My movie recommendation is Windy City Heat, who's having a 10th anniversary. Oh,
a silly movie.
Well, that was the one that was made by Jimmy Kimmel.
Right.
I thought that was a little bit cruel.
Yeah. I find Kimmel cruel.
Yeah. They also have a podcast called The Big Three Podcast. Carl Sagan. The talking point I keep running into in my talks with those on the right is always dead. It seems to be a mantra for them and always leading to blaming Obama. The one point I've never understood is how Bush kept the cost of the wars off the books. What does that mean? And how can the national debt be attributed to a president when it's Congress' responsibility to allocate spending? What are you talking about with the Breaking Bad finale? What should I Google?
If you haven't seen the ending, I would Google nothing. But if you have seen it, you could Google alternate ending.
Yeah.
Some article will bring
alternate,
it up.
Alternate theory.
Interpretation. Yeah.
Breaking Bad. Look, you know, the debt, all I can tell you is that our debt to GDP ratio is, to the extent that there's any research, and much of it's been debunked now, that there is actually a debt-to-GDP ratio which can slow economic growth. The bottom line is the debt will come down once we increase economic growth. There's only one way to increase economic growth, or primary way of doing it, and that is to spend money and make up for what the private sector is not generating in terms of growth. You can't argue with those morons just about debt in general, I don't think. Or go to Stephanie Kelton's blog and Google Stephanie Kelton. She has a couple of good videos on it. Baikada, yes. How about the movie recommendations be posted somewhere on the website? Perhaps a members-only feature.
I think they are.
Aren't they? I think they are somewhere.
Usually.
Well, they're in every post.
I know, but aggregated. Oh,
we'll
Michael,
see.
It's too much work.
We'll see. We'll see.
Do we have a volunteer out there to do it, by Gata? Matt and the BK. We watched the movie a few months ago. Very interesting view of Iran. Dark but poignant. Acting was great. Cannot recall end credits. Have to research that part. Listener, the GOP is like the Titanic crew that locked all the lower class into assure the wealthy got lifeboats only after ramming into an iceberg because they hated the captain. Morella 62. It's true. I'm a big fan of Iranian movies, and all the movies Matthew recommended in the past I watched were great. I think he's your best reviewer ever. Isabella's good, too.
Sure.
Dr. Radman, please. I'm streaming on the Android app, driving down Highway 70 in Missouri. Great work. Works great. Yeehaw. Hopefeld. Guy Lawson got it right on the doctor's strike 51 years ago in Saskatchewan. Them docs are willing to have their own citizens die to maintain high prices and wealth. Same thing in the U.S. in the 1960s with President LBJ and Medicare for the elderly. AMA tried to nix it but lost. All of a sudden, doctors' income boomed. In the Sahara, the economy in which healthcare took up also boomed. That Medicare make doctors rich, rich, rich. The reason Canada got universal Medicare for all was third party called the CCC, the old version of the New Democratic Party, took the deciding position in the federal parliament. The Liberal Party had plurality and needed the NDP and Tommy Douglas's MPs to control government. All right, this is getting a little weedy. The NDP province wide experiment in 61, 62 worked in Saskatchewan and was Saskatchewan premier. The New Democratic Party went to the federal parliament. He pushed for health care for all Canadians. It's a little weedy.
Sometimes the IMs from him are like, I follow him on Twitter. He's such a smart guy. And sometimes though they come like the same way, like a 10-year-old would tell you a story, except if the 10-year-old was like a total genius. It's just like, and then in Saskatchewan, they exchanged the exchange rate. And that shifted when the Democratic Party came to power.
Hopefeld reminds me of this very brilliant engineer I know who will sit down and start, you know, like, what are you working on? And he will start talking to me as if I know anything he's talking about. Well, the calipers, you know, here's the problem with creating, you know, six gear on this is because you need to have, you know, I have absolutely no idea what he's talking about. And he's looking at me like I should know this.
But they're great. Keep them coming.
Yes, they're definitely appreciated. Eurospamed, whenever I'm feeling down about how I messed up the world is, I think back to you saying climate Scientologists and all is right again. Happy to help. Reuters is reporting missing link after a $7.5 billion batch of fines. Yes, Jamie Dimon is even looking even more vulnerable today when JP Morgan posted a $300 million loss, the first quarterly loss since 2004. My understanding is they have spent more on fines and legal costs than they spend on employees.
It's a witch hunt, Sam.
Do you want him to not be Treasury Secretary or something, yeah, Sam?
I'm being so cruel to him. Hi, Sam. Arms and Dudes, I can't wait for the book and the movie. Why do so many weird things emanate from Florida? Jabbles, Stossel and Adam Carolla sound like the same dickhead. Anyone ever see them in the same room together? Good point. Bingo Mosquito, did I just hear strict scrutiny? I'm not sure.
Scrutiny.
Jeffrey 223. First, I am from the app. Now that I have my own 9-month-old, I get your shtick regarding how your children have totally impeded everything that was once enjoyable about life. I love my son, but deeply he is aging me so quickly. I feel like my face is melting. Dude, I totally get it. And now I'm terrified because Saul's just about to become mobile, and this kid, like Mila, had her own set of issues. This kid, it's just different. It's like he just picks up anything. And he's just like, bam, bam, bam. Like, that's it. Like, he's just, like, fascinated by, what is the sound of this if I hit it against the wall? What is the sound of this if I hit it on the ground? What is the sound of this if I hit it against my face? And then it's just like, bam, 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 bam.
He's a scientist.
Yeah. And when he has mobility, it's going to get even worse. I'll tell you something. If we do, really what we should do is putting out a bunch of different podcasts. Stephen Sherrill and I had an idea at one point of doing an anonymous book about how much a father hates his child. But maybe that's the podcast you do, right? Where you're shrouded in darkness and you put on disguise your voice.
I can set that up for you.
Stuck in red hell. Is there one pic of a bunch of trucks in traffic that I've seen promoting their cause and how it started? The pic was of rush hour traffic on 81 in Harrisburg last night. They didn't bother to crop the camera ID or date out of the time picture. All right, the final I am of the week, folks. Quidam. I haven't heard much about Miriam Carey. Is there anything remotely connected to the conspiracy theorists about the lack of news? No, although I haven't seen any reporting about sort of the protocols that I would like to have seen about what the Capitol Police are instructed. I mean, one doesn't know what. It's unclear what the protocols are. I mean, it's quite possible they followed certain protocols that are unique to the Capitol Police because of that situation. But I don't know.
They didn't release much about what happened to her or that guy who lit himself on fire. That guy who lit himself on fire, the guy who self-immolated himself, apparently people there were saying he was saying, screaming something about the Voting Rights Act before he did it. And then when the details came out, they just called him, oh, he was crazy. They didn't even mention anything political he was saying. They just said he was nuts.
Of course not. It's only people who do it in other countries who are doing it for political reasons. All right, folks. Well, you know the drill. You guys, many of you are members. If you've been listening free to the whole show, folks, please become a member if you can afford it. If you can't, we'll help you out. But if you can become a member, please become a member today at majority.fm. And don't forget Credo, credomobile.com/Sam, giving you a great deal on Credo Mobile phone service, $350 to cover your expenses in switching over. You can get a 25% off of data, and it funds a lot of great progressive causes and fights. CredoMobile.com/Sam, JustCoffee.coop. You know our Amazon link. Matt and Mike will be here on Monday. I will see you Tuesday.
Podcast Awards.
PodcastAwards.com. Nominations still open. Please nominate us if you haven't done so already. All right. See you next week.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost or dry,